This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our Radio Main Street across North Dakota. And today, it's Friday. It's time to talk about something fun in front of the weekend. And oftentimes, we talk with Madeline about a new movie that's on the big screen. Of course, the big screen's been pretty dark because of the pandemic. So instead, we've been talking about people who are important in the movies. And today, Matt, we're going to talk about directors, right?
That's exactly right. Some of my favorite directors of all time.
And I think we were going to talk about the unique situation we have with the history of film directing, in that there haven't been too many women directors and there haven't been too many directors of color. So let's start with that issue.
Yeah, so just like last week, we've kind of used these two segments to point out the incredible domination of the movie industry by white men, basically. Now, last week, we did talk about my favorite actresses, but when you get into directors, this is even a bigger issue, because at least when I was growing up, I could see Sidney Poitier on screen. But women directors, black directors, non-existent when I was growing up. And if they were doing films, they were small-budgeted films. Now we're finally seeing an explosion with women directors, for sure. I've noticed that at the Fargo Film Festival the last 5-10 years. But basically, it's tricky. It's not been there. The doors have not been opened. So that is regrettable, but it is changing.
Well, I remember Kathryn Bigelow made a name for herself in the action genre several years ago now.
Hurt Locker and Zero Dark Thirty are just really excellent action pictures. Both of them are good. She won the Oscar for Hurt Locker. There was kind of a thought she might win a second Oscar for Zero Dark Thirty, but Argo kind of pulled the upset with the best picture. I think Zero Dark Thirty is almost a better film. That last 30, 40 minutes, Doug, the tension you feel when the special forces are closing in on Bin Laden's compound. And we've talked about this, Doug. We know the ending, right? We know they got him. But the tension is so enormous as the townspeople are closing in. And Bigelow shoots it almost like you're watching a semi-documentary.
Well, it reminds us also that editing is a very important function of film directing.
It sure is. Jane Campion is another one of my favorite directors. The Piano remains a film that probably would have swept the Oscars had it not been for Schindler's List that year. But she directed Holly Hunter and Anna Paquin to Oscars. I like some of her early films, too, like An Angel at My Table. She's really had some outstanding movies, you know, profiling strong women. So Jane Campion from New Zealand, she's a phenomenal director as well. And a couple others, too, Doug. You know, Chantal Ackerman, who's now passed away, a Belgian film director, her films are really interesting. They're kind of an acquired taste. And another movie I really liked from the late 70s called Girlfriends, starring Melanie Mayron and Eli Wallach, was directed by Claudia Weill. That really has the feel of, you know, 20-something women navigating their lives in New York City in the late 70s. So a couple other shout-outs there. I'm not as wild about Sofia Coppola's films. We've talked about that. You know, have to call him like I see him. I think some of her stuff is fairly overrated. But again, obviously an important voice in cinema right now.
When we were talking about this segment, Skip Wood, our producer, mentioned Penny Marshall, and A League of Their Own is a pretty good film.
I think that's Penny's best film, and thanks for Skip for bringing that up. That is her best film. It's a lot of people's favorite baseball movie. Madonna's even good in it. So that takes some direction to get a good performance out of Madonna, who has been, you know, quite weak, I think, dramatically in some of the performances she's given. So I love League of Their Own. Tom Hanks has a great part in there. Rosie O'Donnell's funny. Madonna's good, if you can believe that, as an actress. So I think that's Penny's best film. I agree with Skip on that.
And I know when it comes to black filmmakers, Steve McQueen is high on your list.
Yeah, I love 12 Years a Slave. Thought he should have got the directing Oscar along with the producing Oscar that he got that year. I actually thought Chiwetel Ejiofor should have won Best Actor. It's just a phenomenal motion picture. You're captivated from the opening frame of that movie. And interestingly, it took a British director, Steve McQueen, you know, black director from Great Britain, to kind of make this, I think, maybe the best film ever made about slavery in the United States. Great performances in that film. You know, Brad Pitt produced it, kind of got it going with McQueen's help. I also like Shame, another movie he made with Michael Fassbender as well.
Well, I'm in favor of Spike Lee. I think I hold him in higher regard than you do. He's got a satirical style. He does cameos like Alfred Hitchcock. And, you know, Black Klansman was a pretty good movie, I thought.
He's very good at narrative structure, Do the Right Thing, kind of remains his big film. He's really been able to work on his own, Doug, for over 30 years, making the films he wants to make. Jungle Fever is a very good film. Crooklyn, Defy Bloods. I told you I like that movie, except for the kind of ludicrous storyline of these Vietnam veterans trudging through the jungle again, seemingly without any health issues. But he is definitely a strong voice. He's made his own films. He's an auteur for sure, and remains a very important voice in cinema today. And of course, it almost goes without saying, Jordan Peele is a major force in cinema right now with Us and Get Out, and very excited to see what he's got in store for the future.
Well, let's look at the 20th century, the golden age of Hollywood. Alfred Hitchcock comes to mind.
I think he's still my number one, Doug. Nobody has ever used the resources of movie making better than Hitchcock. You know, he once said, you can really watch his movies without the dialogue and you can figure out what's going on. He loved to build suspense. I think he was a better director of actors than he ever claimed to be. You know, he viewed them as cattle. That was his famous quote about actors. But he loved Cary Grant and Jimmy Stewart. He kept using them over and over. He has very few misses in his canon of work, Doug. Even kind of that middle-range Hitchcock film like I Confess or Rope or something like that remains entertaining. He only has really two or three or four, I think, bad films like Topaz was not very good, Under Capricorn, Jamaica Inn. He just kept churning them out within the studio system. He was able to kind of work within the studio system and put his stamp on films. You could tell when you were watching a Hitchcock movie. He famously could plot the whole thing out in his head ahead of time. He had storyboards. He knew exactly shot for shot what he was doing, so he never had to shoot excess footage like some directors do. He knew exactly what he wanted within the scene. Still, you know, he is probably, along with Steven Spielberg, the most famous film director to general audiences in the history of movies.
Well, he was innovative with the camera, too. You mentioned Rope, and I'm thinking of Rear Window, where the camera is basically Jimmy Stewart's eyes.
Yeah, he was always using something different from movie to movie. And, you know, this is now the 60th anniversary of Psycho this year, and that film remains groundbreaking because he kills off Janet Leigh within 45 minutes. And I know people who saw that movie when it came out, and they were stunned by what they saw. And the film has been influential over the years. I think North by Northwest remains my favorite Hitchcock film. But I like some of his old ones in the 40s, too, like Shadow of a Doubt, Notorious, and Rebecca.
Well, let's talk about a director of epics, David Lean.
He's also right near the top for me, Doug. And he made smaller movies before the epics he's known for. Oliver Twist, 1948. Great Expectations is a phenomenal film from 1947. So he did two really good Dickens adaptations. Brief Encounter is a great film. Summertime, which gave Katharine Hepburn one of her best roles. But it's the epics people remember. Of the five epics he made, Ryan's Daughter is the weakest. I think Lawrence of Arabia stands out as an example of an epic film that's also intimate, that gives you a character study that Peter O'Toole pulls off on screen. It remains the film that Steven Spielberg was most influenced by. And he famously said, Doug, that when he saw the film in high school, he saw it twice, he was depressed because he felt David Lean had set the bar too high and he could never reach that bar. Now, if the film was shot, Doug, it would be CGI. The desert would look like the Mummy films with Brendan Fraser. But that was showmanship back then. He spent a year in the desert shooting that movie with Peter O'Toole, Omar Sharif, and a cast of thousands, and people still talk about it to this day.
Eric Rohmer is that French New Wave director, so we're talking about foreign directors here.
He is a very acquired taste, not someone that the general public knows very well. He's been called the French Woody Allen. A lot of talking in his movies. They're basically movies about relationships. My Night at Maud's from 1969 is probably a good starting point if you haven't seen a Rohmer film. Claire's Knee, 1970. And then he did these tales of summer, spring, winter, and fall in the 1990s that are wonderful to watch. Once you've kind of jumped into the world of Rohmer, I found myself just captivated by his movies. Love in the Afternoon, 1972 is another great one. They usually involve, you know, kind of younger middle-aged men who are struggling with things, but he also has very strong female characters in his movies. He passed away a few years ago. His style is hard to put your finger on. It's very simple. There's not a lot of directing tricks, but he knows exactly what he's doing, and you can tell when you're watching a Romero film.
I read it described as moral tales that explore the contrast between what people say and what they do.
That's about right. That's pretty good.
Louis Bunuel has one of the most famous scenes in movie history.
Which one is that? Are you talking about?
The Sliced Eye.
Oh, The Sliced Eye, yes, in Un Chien Andalou, 1928. Yes, that's a movie that gets shown in film schools to this day. He had a very uneven career. He started out, you know, great with those movies, but then he had a long period where he was working intermittently, not getting big budgets. And eventually he found his way to Mexico, where he made Robinson Crusoe in 1954, which kind of got him back on track. And then so many great films he made in France near the end of his career. Belle du Jour with Catherine Deneuve, The Exterminating Angel, Vera Diana, The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie. Again, he's known as a surreal artist. So there's some scenes in his films that make no sense, but you know you're watching a Bunuel film.
Well, that was the first film I ever saw where I had to look at the floor. That's a very strong scene. Paul Thomas Anderson is quite a skilled director in his own right.
He's one of the two sort of modern directors I put in this top 10. He's really grown on me over the years, Doug, and he's got a style that kind of is imitative of 1970s cinema, kind of that Robert Altman style, but he's kind of found his own voice, especially with Daniel Day-Lewis. The partnership with Daniel Day-Lewis has produced There Will Be Blood, and Phantom Thread, two phenomenal performances by Day-Lewis, especially There Will Be Blood. I remember when I saw that trailer, I predicted he'd win the Oscar, and he did. But I love Magnolia, Boogie Nights, typically a lot of plot points going on in his films, multiple plots, multiple characters. But I think The Master might be my favorite film by Paul Thomas Anderson, which ostensibly is about L. Ron Hubbard and the Scientology movement, with Philip Seymour Hoffman playing that role, but also Joaquin Phoenix in the lead role as this ex-soldier who gets drawn into Scientology. And there's some great scenes in that movie. The film didn't make a lick of money in this country, but it did get some Oscar nominations. But over the years, that's a film that has really grown in stature amongst critics and moviegoers. I love his style.
I imagine a lot of people hope that Paul Thomas Anderson can draw Daniel Day-Lewis out of retirement.
If anybody can, I think it's him. But I heard that the Phantom Thread shoot was a difficult shoot, and you probably heard that as well, Doug, and Daniel Day-Lewis had kind of just had it. I don't know that he was upset with Paul Thomas Anderson, but I think that commitment that Daniel Day-Lewis does toward his roles, and you talked about he made a gown. You know, he sewed and made a garment to get ready for that movie. And I just wonder if he's the guy that can draw him out, if there might have to be some deal-making between he and the great man, the great actor. But if anybody can draw him out of retirement, it is Paul Thomas Anderson, I think.
Quentin Tarantino has a style, and it's a bold one. Over-the-top violence comes to mind for me.
Now, 2 years ago, he would not have been in my top 10, but I loved Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I think it was the best film of last year, along with Parasite. And I recently rewatched Django Unchained with my son, and when I reviewed it with you in 2012, I was underwhelmed. But the second time I watched it, it is really a commentary on the absurdity and the absolute horror of slavery. There are scenes in there that are hard to get out of your mind. Now, of course, there's a comedic element to the whole thing. You know, Calvin Candy, Candyland, Leonardo DiCaprio's performance. And you're drawn in by this. You're horrified, of course, that he's got this plantation and he's having his slaves fight each other. But it really, I think Tarantino actually kind of walks that line pretty well in that movie between revenge fantasy, which we get at the end, like we always do. We got that with Inglourious Basterds and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Christoph Waltz, of course, another great performance in that film, his second Oscar. And I love Inglourious Basterds, Pulp Fiction, Reservoir Dogs. I think those are his five best movies, but he has a style all his own. No one can write screenplay like he can. the scenes kind of go on and on and on. And they're building to something. He's a great writer, but he's also kind of got a visual style. And, you know, he's been criticized for kind of stealing from spaghetti westerns and other kind of kung fu movies that he loves. But within those kind of genre-bending things, he has created his own style that's completely all his own.
Fred Zinnemann is on your list, and he has some very big movies in his repertoire.
He did. Now, yeah, he was from Austria. He and Billy Wilder were friends when they were young, and they worked on a film called People on Sunday, and both, luckily, got out of Europe. They're both Jewish film directors, got out of Europe in the 30s, found a place in Hollywood. Zinnemann wasn't a director that called a lot of attention to himself. Very self-effacing, very kind of subtle in his films, but his big ones are great. A Man for All Seasons, From Here to Eternity, High Noon, The Nun Story. I even like his later films like Julia and The Day of the Jackal. He was not a director like Hitchcock or Orson Welles that kind of called attention to the art of directing. He was very subtle. His films usually involve men kind of fighting against the system, men alone. Think of Monty Clift in From Here to Eternity, Gary Cooper in High Noon, Paul Scofield, you know, being executed for his views against Henry VIII and the church in Man for All Seasons, Day of the Jackal, a loner, of course, who tries to murder de Gaulle. He really was a great craftsman. Actors love to work with him as
Orson
well.
Orson Welles had a pretty uneven career, but he created one of the great movies of all time, one of my favorites, Citizen Kane.
It's one of my favorites, too. I think it still holds up. The camera choreography and some of the scenes in that movie is just phenomenal. It doesn't look like other films from 1941. It just doesn't. Of course, you know, Herman Mankiewicz was a huge help on that film, co-writing the script with Welles. Very uneven career, just like Boonwell. After Citizen Kane, you know, Magnificent Ambersons was famously re-edited down to kind of mush, but it's still a good film. The shootout in the Hall of Mirrors, Doug, at the end of Lady from Shanghai. What a great scene that is. And then he comes back with Universal in 1958 to shoot Touch of Evil on time, on budget. Great, tight little thriller. That opening scene, all done in one take without any editing, as the bomb goes off, as Charlton Heston and Janet Leigh are on their honeymoon in that town near the Mexican border. Very uneven career. But again, he had a style all his own, kind of that overlapping dialogue that Howard Hawks perfected and Robert Altman perfected as well later. He's got to be on this list simply because of Citizen Kane, a film that, you know, broke ground with its screenplay as well, Doug. That screenplay is so intricate. Flashbacks within flashbacks, different people telling multiple stories about what they thought of Kane. So the screenplay is a work of art.
And it's social commentary. It's about William Randolph Hearst, who was a media magnate at the time, and he basically tried to squash the movie. It didn't work.
You know, the funny thing about that, Doug, is Welles probably never topped Kane, and William Randolph Hearst's reputation was kind of ruined by that movie. The real winner in all this has been the movie. The film has sustained itself over 79 years, whereas Welles and Hearst both never quite achieved those heights again.
I just remember the dramatic lighting. The cinematography in the film is out of this world to me. I just think it's amazing.
It is. Greg Toland.
Martin Scorsese. Here's a guy who's made a lot of big movies, too.
Yeah, I haven't liked his last two, The Irishman and Silence. But again, he's got more hits than misses. And that's a crucial thing when I'm looking through this list. You know, his misses are New York, New York. Silence isn't very good. But he's kind of known for one kind of film, you know, kind of tough guys on the streets, Goodfellas, Mean Streets, things like that, Casino. But Cape Fear, his remake of Cape Fear is, I think, an improvement on the original. Taxi Driver remains one of those movies that just defines the 1970s, a film that had a lot of influence on a lot of directors. I don't like Raging Bull quite as much as critics like it. I mean, it's a fine film with a great performance by Robert De Niro. But I look at some of Scorsese's smaller films, Doug, like The King of Comedy, which is this kind of farce about a crazy guy kidnapping a talk show host played by Jerry Lewis. That film was very influential on Joker, which came out last year. After Hours is a nice little film he made in the mid-80s. I like Last Temptation of Christ. He got a great performance out of Willem Dafoe in that movie. I don't like his films as well when he's kind of going for period pieces, like The Age of Innocence, which feels kind of slow, Gangs of New York. Great performance by Daniel Day-Lewis. of course, in that one. But the film isn't quite a masterpiece. Wolf of Wall Street, though, I love that one, despite all the swearing. I like Shutter Island a lot on second viewing. And Hugo is such an interesting movie that he made, which really doesn't feel like a Scorsese movie.
I recently rewatched The Color of Money, which is sort of a sequel of The Hustler. It even has Paul Newman in it, with Tom Cruise in this case. But I think The Hustler's a better movie, to be honest.
It is a better movie. But, you know, Scorsese famously got Paul Newman his Oscar by giving him another chance as Fast Eddie.
Well, let's end our discussion with one of the more controversial directors because of his personal life, Woody Allen.
Yeah, Woody Allen's a tricky guy to talk about anymore. Because of Me Too and some things like that. You know, he remains this kind of polarizing figure amongst the public, but he's got 8 or 10, I think, great movies. Now, unfortunately, he's got some duds, and he's been coming up with them lately. He has not made a good film since Blue Jasmine. But when he's on, like with Manhattan and Annie Hall and Hannah and Her Sisters and Deconstructing Harry, Husbands and Wives, when he's on with a film like that, or Vicky Cristina Barcelona, Midnight in Paris, they're easy to watch. They're funny. He's got kind of that invisible Hollywood style of editing where you can't really tell. He's not a flashy director, but you can tell you're watching a Woody Allen movie. He famously gets along well with his actors, kind of lets them do what they want to do. He's directed a lot of women to Oscar wins as well. So if you're But it's a very uneven career. He probably makes too many movies, as you know, one movie per year, and so he's probably recycling scripts. I think his problem now, Doug, is he can't find distribution within this country because of the allegations of sexual abuse involving his child. He was not charged with that crime. We need to mention that, but I don't know where the truth lies in that story. I really don't. His main problem now is he can't get distribution, and he really needs a younger co-screenwriter to kind of jump him into the 21st century, because his films feel, you feel like you're watching an old man's movie sometimes, especially the most recent ones.
Well, he is that auteur. He was a writer on Sid Caesar's comedy variety show with Carl Reiner, the late Carl Reiner. He was a stand-up comedian. You know, he did TV, he did films, mm-hmm. and you mentioned a number of them. One of my favorites, actually, is Broadway Danny Rose, because it's kind of an inside story. And The Purple Rose of Cairo, actually, is clever. I like his work, like you, you know, and Bananas comes to mind, because that's just crazy.
Bananas is great, yeah.
but he does have this personal life, which kind of gets in the way of his legacy, I think.
It's a messy personal life. I think we can all agree on that. Marrying Sun Yi, although they're still together, remains a controversial move on his part. Let's just call it a messy personal life, kind of like Marlon Brando, who you mentioned last week, had a messy personal life as well.
And Roman Polanski.
Well, yeah, we won't go there. That is proven what he did, and that was horrible and egregious and everything else. He's made some great movies, of course, but not in my top 10. But, you know, Woody remains a guy that's, you know, he has hits, he has misses. You either respond to his filmmaking style or you don't.
We've been to the movies and talked directors with Matt O'Lee. Coming up on Main Street, choral director Tom Porter with an online choral project that got a lot of attention. Ashley Thornburg will talk with him about that, and we'll have our weekly news chat with Dave Thompson. First, the news.
29 minutes past the hour. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald. 84 new individuals have tested positive for COVID-19 in North Dakota, bringing the new statewide positive to 4,154. The results were from a pool of 5,557 tests. The daily positive rate is 1.5%. Burleigh County reported the most new cases at 24. Cass County was second at 19. Grand Forks County had 9 new cases. Stark and Williams counties each reported 4 new cases. Cavalier, Montreal, and Walsh reported 3. Morton and Trail counties had 2 each. And Dunn, McIntosh, Mercer, Pierce, Ramsey, Richland, Sioux, Steele, and Towner counties each had 1 new case. 33 people are currently hospitalized with COVID-19. There have been 260 hospitalizations total. North Dakota's Industrial Commission has okayed a plan by EOG Resources to use 5 well bores to store natural gas. State Mineral Resources Director Lynn Helms says the company is planning to inject natural gas into those wellbores whenever the Palermo gas plant is offline or the Alliance pipeline is down, which happens routinely.
The current option is to flare the gas.
Helms says under this proposal, the gas would be salvaged.
It would be used for enhanced oil recovery. It's anticipated that there will be an increase in oil recovery associated with this. But at a bare minimum, the gas that would normally be flared will be salvaged and will ultimately go back to market.
Helms says EOG has used this kind of technique in Texas. Attorney General Wayne Stengem has granted the City of Fargo's request to authorize the Bureau of Criminal Investigation to investigate the actions of former Fargo Deputy Police Chief Todd Osmundson. Consultations between Mayor Mahoney, Police Chief Todd, and the city attorney started after the police department's internal investigation into Osmundson. All parties agreed that charges should not be pursued, but the city says that to ensure impartiality, it's important to seek an independent inquiry. Spokeswoman Liz Brocker says that Stengem has assigned a supervising agent to the case. She says the BCI will follow its normal procedures and complete a report at the conclusion of its review. The BCI will look into claims that Osmundson publicly consumed alcohol and incited a riot. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
You're listening to the song Prairie Wind, composed and conducted by Dr. Tom Porter of the University of Mary. This is Main Street on Prairie Public, and Tom joins me now by phone. Tom, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome, Ashley. It's a pleasure to be here.
What inspired the song Prairie Wind?
Well, it actually got started because I applied for a North Dakota Council on the Arts Individual Artist Fellowship in 2019. And my proposal for the fellowship was to write a piece for North Dakota choirs to sing. So I was looking for a poet or a poem that was closely tied to our experience here, then also aware of the different types of choirs that we have in North Dakota. I found a poem by a poet who lived in Aberdeen, South Dakota. Her name was Thelma Hill Ward. And it was Prairie Wind, and I thought, how appropriate. That's something that we can all relate to here. I worked with the poem a little bit and figured out how I could use it and adapt it to be lyrics for a song and composed the piece.
And I'm going to go out on a limb here and guess that you did not anticipate there being a global pandemic when you were wanting to record this.
Right. No, I was not thinking about that at all. In fact, the parameters of the fellowship were that I would write the piece, I was going to present it to the North Dakota Choral Directors, which I actually had the chance to do last February before everything shut down. And then in March, April, May, I was going to do some residencies around North Dakota and work with choirs and attend performances and do some presentations at care facilities and things like that. And of course, all that went by the wayside. So I was kind of stuck in saying, well, now what? What am I going to do with this piece of music? During the shutdown, there were a lot of musicians who turned to virtual performances. And I thought, this is something that we can do. So I contacted choral directors around the state, did some postings and just let people know that this was available, went through the whole process of getting the materials that they needed out online so that individuals could make recordings of themselves singing the song.
And you got 140 people to participate in this. This is not blending three voices here.
Right. So 140 people, that's a big amount of data to compile. We had people from all throughout the state, people from New York, Alabama, Minnesota, Illinois. We had some people send in videos from Germany and Indonesia. So I'm not quite sure how they got word of it, but they did. And they contacted me and said, can we participate? And I said, sure. So I got all of these recordings back. And part of the return process was people would identify themselves by section, soprano, alto, tenor, bass. And then we had to take every one of those videos and edit the video for sound and put them all together.
I know how much work it is to do that kind of editing. That's a lot of work.
It is. It is. And I was very thankful that we received some funding from the North Dakota American Choral Directors Association and from the Bismarck Mannan Civic Chorus. They each chipped in half of the production costs. So I was actually able to hire out someone to do the sound editing and someone to do the video editing, because there is no way. I mean, I would still be knee deep in that stuff, and it would not be nearly as nice as it is right now.
Well, you can find it on YouTube. The song is called Prairie Wind. Let's take a few seconds to listen to this blended voices. We're visiting with Dr. Tom Porter. He composed the music for Prairie Wind, inspired by a poem by South Dakota poet Thelma Hill Ward. And you are listening to 140 singers from across the nation and even other countries join their voices in song. And Tom, I'm wondering, during the pandemic, you know, right away, there was kind of this fear response to it. And then all of a sudden people got very creative. And I think this is a great example of that. And I'm wondering, has how you view music or your approach to music changed during this time?
There was certainly a collective gasp among performing artists. It cut to the heart of who we are and what we do. And that's still being felt. I mean, there are a number of symphonies that are not coming back at all for the season. Broadway is shut down until 2021. These are people who make their living doing this. I'm very grateful for the fact that I'm not a performing musician by trade. This was something that I love to do and something that I feel privileged to have the opportunity to do, but it's not my livelihood. So I did have a chance, in a little bit easier setting, to step back and say, what can we do with this now? But, you know, I see stuff online. I see people coming up with creative things. People who are having summer concerts in their driveways and inviting people just to come and social distance and wear their masks and enjoy the live music in an outdoor setting where we don't have as much worry about spreading disease. Online versions of things are just exploding. Before all of this happened, you could go online and you could find virtual choir projects. Now it's like every choir in the country has put out something. And that's wonderful because it gives us an opportunity to share our gifts in a different way and to a different audience.
Have you noticed that among any of your students, that their approach to music or even just their sense of appreciation of music has changed?
Definitely. And people are so much more aware, not taking anything for granted, being aware of the gift of coming together and making music together and what that means to one's mind, what that means to one's spirit, what that means to one's heart. Realizing that it really speaks to what it means to be human, to come together and make art.
Was there anything specific in the poem that really inspired you, or was it the whole poem?
First of all, it was just the concept of the wind. I've done a number of compositions of North Dakota, South Dakota poets, and I'm always amazed of their perspective of things. You know, so many of us, we go outside and it's windy and it's just like, oh no, it's windy again today. And we just kind of, we brace ourselves against it. And poetry like this, instead of bracing against it, is embracing it. That's what I find wonderful. You know, the images of wind as being life and energy and just a source of hope and identity for us on the prairie.
Yeah, the line, the rustling wind in poplar tree bids me come gypsying today.
Right. It's a real embracing of what it is. And teaching out at University of Mary, I mean, we're just situated up on a hill and there's nothing between us and the wind. I see my students come in every day just kind of wind rustled. And sometimes I just find that need to go out and stand in it and just let it surround me. Part of who we are is prairie people.
Dr. Tom Porter is a professor of music and the chair of the music department at the University of Mary in Bismarck, and he composed the music for Prairie Wind, the North Dakota Choir Project 2020. Funding for this project came from an individual arts fellowship through the North Dakota Council on the Arts. Tom, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome, Ashley. Thank you.
And let's go out with just a little bit more of Prairie Wind.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Recently, in a forum I was in on Facebook, the question came up of the use of gravy to refer to pasta sauce.
Yellow bananas grow black spots like cheetah fur. Time to bake some bread.
Tune in to Away With Words.
Oh, please just go dry up and bust.
That's Away With Words, Saturday at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
On Fridays, that wire machine means it's time for a couple of old news hounds to talk about the week's big stories, and that means News Director Dave Thompson joins us by his microphone at our studio in Bismarck to talk about what he's been talking about. And coronavirus, of course,
it sure is
number one week after week.
It is, and the real change this time is that the, if you want to put it, the leader in infections has now seemed to be shifting to Burley County instead of Cass County, which I thought was kind of interesting. And there are lots of theories about why, but I don't think anybody really knows why it might be, except there has been increased testing in Burley County. There's been a couple of events, one at the Capitol, one downtown in Bismarck, where there were a lot of people tested.
Well, I noted that the Missouri River seemed to help Morton County because they only had two.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
The big story of the week otherwise was the judge's order shutting down the Dakota Access Pipeline for this environmental review.
It has dominated, I think, the news almost as much as COVID has been dominating for the past several weeks. But there's all sorts of things in it. Is the pipeline going to be shut down? Are appeals going to be filed? And they're saying they need to shut the pipeline down until the Corps of Engineers finishes an environmental impact statement. Now, the Corps did an environmental assessment before the pipeline had been built, and now they're saying you do a full EIS. And the judge now has ruled that while you're doing the EIS, you must shut the pipeline down. And that's going to be the contentious part of the appeal right now, to see if they can keep operating it while the Corps finishes its environmental impact statement.
I believe in his order he said they should shut it down by sometime in August. Is that correct?
That is correct. It gave him 30 days from the order, which was dated last Monday. So it's going to be early August when it has to be shut down, or they think it's going to have to be shut down. But Energy Transfer says it's going to take longer than that to actually do a shutdown, which I think is kind of interesting. There are some people I've talked to who are experts in the pipeline industry and also people on the environmental side saying it might be rushing it a little bit for this 500,000-gallon pipeline to be shut down in a matter of just a month.
Well, I think it has to be shut down if there's ever a spill, so that doesn't happen in a month, I don't think.
No, but remember, you're shutting the whole thing down.
Yes.
In a spill, the way it's designed right now, at least that's the theory, that they can shut down the section of the pipeline where the spill is.
Okay. Of course, one of the arguments for the DAPL was that it would reduce the cost of transporting North Dakota crude oil and therefore
right.
get a bigger return on per barrel. So the timing, however, could have been worse. I mean, it's not like the Bakken is booming right now.
No, the Bakken is down, but there is still oil flowing through the Dakota Access Pipeline. And now you might have to shift that oil to rail. And they're talking about rail is a significant discount because you can charge transportation against it. And that's why a Bakken and barrel will fetch less money in some of these destinations.
And we'll see more of those oil trains, I guess.
Yes, and that's also a concern because there are some states who have tried to prohibit oil trains from actually, you know, bringing Bakken crude to the refineries. I'm thinking about Washington State tried to. But there was still the concern about some of the older rail cars that were used to ship oil. Apparently those are now all updated and might be a bit safer.
You reported on Wednesday that the Industrial Commission could be filing a friend of the court brief in this particular case. And also you reported that they decided against imposing mandatory oil production cuts, which I didn't know they had the authority to do.
They did, and that dates back to the 50s and 60s, you know, the early days of the oil play in North Dakota, that, you know, given there, if there was an emergency situation where the price just went through the floor, they could basically order a shutdown. Now, everybody says things have changed, and they have, because Bakken crude is a lot different than, say, normal drilling activity, and there's been a lot more of it. And so there was a lot of concern among the industry about, you know, should the state have the authority to shut in production? And they decided overwhelmingly no, that should be up to a company's decision, you know, based on the marketplace.
And it would be in the, you know, financial interest here. The state does get an extraction tax, which is affected by the price of the
barrel.
Correct. Big story on our end of the state actually went into Minnesota. That we had a terrible tornado blow through here a couple days ago.
Yeah, Dalton, Minnesota and Otter Tail County. You had one death and two injuries. A number of houses were damaged or destroyed. There were a number of outbuildings that were damaged or destroyed. And I know that there's a cleanup going on right now, but there's also an assessment that the National Weather Service came out with a preliminary assessment that the tornado was a EF3.
Big one.
Yeah, big one with wind speeds up to 165 miles per hour. So you're talking about a tornado that formed very quickly and kind of surprised an awful lot of people. So
there was compelling video of it. Lots of people actually captured it, and it was a big one. And we should acknowledge that the person who died, Seth Nelson, left a wife and four kids. So.
Right, and now there's a GoFundMe account to support the family, basically.
A reminder that we're in tornado season.
Yes, we are, and we are in some severe weather watches in parts of North Dakota, at least watching the potential for severe weather again.
Another big story out of Fargo is that the former deputy police chief, Todd Osmondson's resignation and the behaviors that led up to it is going to be investigated by the attorney general. At least Fargo's asked for that investigation.
Right. They'll ask for it, and then the attorney general would probably turn it over to the Bureau of Criminal Investigation. But if that can't be accomplished, they have an agreement with South Dakota, and South Dakota's BCI equivalent would probably do the investigation. But it all depends on, you know, his actions during that riot where – he was supposedly – or he was telling people that he was undercover. And the police chief and the mayor said they knew nothing about that. So there's a lot of things at play here.
He got a one-week suspension for those actions, and he resigned shortly after that. And,
right.
There was some issue raised about his pension benefits, which are over $9,000 a month for the rest of his life. So that's not insignificant. And
no.
The city is saying that was not why he resigned, out of fear of losing his pension benefits. So that's out there too.
I know. That's a lot of things at play in this one, you know, as we've gone through the whole issue with Black Lives Matter and the protests and some of the protests that turned violent. Actually, it's just the one, from what I understand. There have been some events since that time that have remained peaceful, which is good.
It was the evening of May 30th when the march was earlier in the day, and then the evening things got a bit ugly downtown.
Mm-hmm.
Big story for Hillsborough and Mayville. Natural gas service could be coming to those towns.
Right. Now, you're talking about what's driving this is probably American Crystal Sugar because they've got that plant just north of Hillsborough, and they would like to convert that from propane to natural gas. So this pipeline company is going to bring natural gas to Trail County. It'll probably serve Hillsborough and Mayville and that plant. And we're thinking some other cities in the county will also get some of that natural gas service too.
So they'll have the benefit of natural gas service, which is less expensive than propane.
Yeah, that's correct. And natural gas right now is plentiful.
Yeah. Even with the cutbacks in the Bakken, there's plenty
exactly.
of gas.
Exactly, there's plenty of gas.
You had a story about XL Energy being fined for not having these aircraft light detection systems installed on their wind farm in Dickey County. And that, I realized, goes back several months. It goes back to late December.
It sure does. This is a new wind farm in Dickey County. And basically, state law says you have to have a different type of lighting system on this other than these blinking red lights that everybody's familiar with. They want it so that there's some kind of detection system so the lights will only turn on when there's aircraft in the area. So that was supposed to be on the new turbine towers. Well, along came January 1st and they had the wind farm and it was up and running. And they said because of cold weather, the weather situation, they couldn't install the new ones. They said it would take a few weeks. However, it wasn't until April till they were installed. So the Public Service Commission said, okay, we're going to levy a fine. And it's going to be a kind of a message to other developers of wind farm that if there is a deadline, you have to try to meet the deadline to the best of your ability.
All right. And finally, Sioux County, which is not heavily populated, is going to a mail-in ballot election system permanently.
Yes, I talked to the county auditor down there, and she was so excited. She said it went so well that she decided that she was going to ask the county commission to make it permanent. Sioux County had five precincts, and because of COVID, she was worried about getting enough workers to get to the precincts. And then the governor said everything goes by mail and you don't have to have a precinct. Now, she says even if the governor does not have that in place, she will have one precinct. It will be at the Sioux County Courthouse. But the rest of it, she's going to do by mail because it was so successful.
Well, a lot of us might be voting by mail this general election.
I think that very well may be true because we don't know about COVID at this point.
We check in with our news director, Dave Thompson, every Friday. Always a pleasure, Dave.
Thank you, Doug.
Recently on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we discussed the new rules for baseball in the COVID era.
Now, the main thing is you can touch your crotch, but just don't touch your face right afterwards.
I'm Peter Sagal. We'll adhere to all safety rules when we're joined by actor Jamila Jamil on this week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Saturday at 10 Central, 9 Mountain.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 10th. 1976 was America's bicentennial year, and it brought celebrations across the country, but the year was doubly special for Mohall, North Dakota. Residents on this date in 1976 were in the middle of a week-long celebration of the town's 75th anniversary, their Diamond Jubilee. The schedule of events included a musical history in front of 1,000 people at the high school auditorium. The history of Mo Hall is forever tied to M. O. Hall, who helped establish the town site in 1901. But he realized something was missing if the town were to grow, and that it was a newspaper. He and several neighbors hauled a printing press and supplies from nearby Kenmare. Hall built a newspaper office and store, and just after Christmas, 1901, the first edition of the Hall News published. And its building was more than just a newspaper office. It became a headquarters of sorts for the development of Mohall, housing a bank, land office, boarding house, post office, and other functions. A schoolroom was on the building's second floor. The town was named Mohall because postal authorities rejected Hall, because there was already a Hall, North Dakota. So Mr. Hall just added his initials to the post office, and the application made it Mohall. There were some interesting milestones during Mohall's early years. Hall's wife drove in the golden spike that marked the arrival of the railroad service to town in 1903. And in 1910, Mohall scored a notable victory in winning the designation of Renville County seat after North Dakota's Supreme Court settled the political drama over the division of Ward County. The campaign for county seat had been bitter. Five towns competed, including Sherwood and Tawley, but Mohall won with a plurality of 619 votes out of 1,826 cast. 1,500 people attended a celebration of the victory with a dinner and a dance. But Mohall leaders considered the town's single greatest achievement in its first 75 years to be the establishment of the Renville-Bottineau Memorial Hospital in 1952. It wasn't all roses in those early years. Some businesses burned down, and there were crop failures in the 1910s. All three of Mohall's banks closed. And during the Great Depression, the aquifer feeding the city wells went dry, leading to a water shortage for years before a new source was found miles from town. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Jack Dura. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
It's Amy Schumer as you've never seen or heard her before.
Oh my God, he's moving all around.
I'm puking every day.
Expecting Amy, her new docuseries about preparing to give birth to a child and a new stand-up act at the same time. And all the latest news Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
7 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street, and a reminder that you can listen to us virtually anywhere now because you don't have to be near a radio all the time. We stream at prairiepublic.org the same time we broadcast, and after the broadcast, you can find Main Street at prairiepublic.org, any Main Street show. On Monday, we're going to talk about the International Music Camp cancellation this year, first time that's happened since 1956. We'll talk about that with co-directors Tim and Christine Bauman. And Leanne Birch is the departing director now of the North Dakota Department of Corrections. She'll reflect on her time in the state in a conversation with our news director, Dave Thompson. That's coming up on Monday. On Sunday, our show will feature Dr. Nadeem Khan, who's a researcher at the University of North Dakota looking into possible vaccines for COVID-19. And we'll revisit a conversation we had with Jack Russell Weinstein about this Sunday's Why Show, about free speech and hate speech. We hope you can join us for Main Street whenever you listen. And in the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.